to call the first case today, 00-0467, in way the commitment of Tori Rachel, Stacey Rachel. Richard Hart, representing Mr. Rachel. May proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity on behalf of Mr. Rachel to address you on this issue. As the court is aware, Mr. Rachel was petitioned by the state to be a sexually violent person. In that respect, he ultimately went to trial. Mr. Rachel decided at trial, basically his defense was not to contest that he was a sexually violent person under Chapter 980, but rather that he should be entitled to supervised release, having been found to be a sexually violent person. Approximately a week before the trial, Council became aware, and I think the legislature passed as part of the budget bill in 1999, substantial changes to Chapter 980. These changes effectively wiped out the ability of the court to order supervised release as one of its conditions once having found a person to be a sexually violent person. It is our position that these changes, various changes that were made to Chapter 980, basically strip the constitutionality that this court had found to substantiate Chapter 980 in the first instance. There is the issue concerning what standard of review to apply in this case. As the Court of Appeals indicated when it certified this case, the original decision was made under findings of Hafler. Justice Bradley wrote the decision in Carpenter, and basically this court followed the dictates of Hafler in deciding that Chapter 980 was constitutional. Since then, the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, has indicated that they felt the Hafler decision was not appropriately decided. It was an approach decision, apparently, they felt, and they indicated in their decision in Hudson that the Hafler approach would lead to results that they didn't want or expect to different things that might happen. However, I point the court out to the dissent in Hudson from Justice Stevens, where he indicated basically that although the court indicated that they implied that there were a rash of cases that might be inappropriately granted or that might lead to erroneous decisions, yet there were only six or seven, none of which got past the Court of Appeals using that decision. So it seems that the Supreme Court basically decided that they had propounded an analytical framework that they no longer liked, and they were going back basically to the older decision. Again, I've submitted to the court, and I understand that this court has always historically followed U.S. Supreme Court decisions in regards to these constitutional issues because our Constitution is similar, if not identical, to U.S. Supreme Court. However, as indicated in my brief, I do invite the court to look at that. Obviously, the Supreme Court has decided that they've made a mistake in regards to how they approach these cases and how they look at them.
Do you think they've made a mistake?
I don't know that they made a mistake. I think they're looking at it from an analytical standpoint. How do we approach these cases? How do we look at them? They went one way. Now they don't like it. Now they've gone back. And I think from your perspective, from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you're not looking at decisions. Obviously, you have to follow decisions of the Supreme Court. But how you look at it, how you get to the decision, I think is in your discretion. And certainly don't have to follow that.
Counsel, we were given a chart, so to speak, and I think you received it from Facebook a couple of days ago. And just looking at that, I think one of your arguments seems to be that, they're no longer eligible for, quote, supervised release, and that basically what the legislature has said with their 1999 amendments is that you're now in for 18 months, and that's, you can't do anything about that. And you seem to, at least in your brief, I thought you seem to say that, well, that is true. But when I look at this chart, and I just call your attention to the second, third page, which is Chapter 980 timelines after the 1999 Wisconsin Act 9 amendment, the state is indicating that, wait a minute, your client or others in this area do have the opportunity to, after 6 months, file. And is that, do you disagree with this chart? Are you having...
Yes, Your Honor, to a certain extent. If I can explain why. If you look at the before chart, starting with that.
Okay, the first row.
With all due respect to Mr. Weinstein, I doctored this chart up here a little bit. First of all, you have to extend it. They're using timelines here, but the timeline on the after chart is reduced. So when I talk 6 months, if you really want to use the timeline, you have to extend it out. First of all, if you look at the chart, the third box in from the left indicates that the court has the ability to either order commitment or supervised release. Now, that was upheld by this court and is a substantial part of this court's decision in both Carpenter and Post. Effectively, what the 1999 amendment did is cross that off, it's wiped that out totally. And that's why I've written on mine, Carpenter and Post, and basically X'd them out, because basically they wiped out that part of your decision. You then go down here and look where they have the supervised release. Here, actually, if you want to extend it out, it would go way out here. So on a chart, it looks substantially different. Before, they could apply for 6 months, now 18 months before supervised release. Now they say, well, it's true that a person here can petition for discharge at any time. That's true, but if you look at it under Section 980.10, there are ramifications. First of all, if the person petitions for discharge and is not granted, then there are sanctions, basically. Any subsequent petitions for discharge have to be provided more material, has to be more substantiation, and almost basically it's just the burden of proof to the detainee. So it's not that easy. Secondly, there's no guarantee that he will get supervised release. What they're saying is he can petition for...
Never work any guarantee under either one.
Yeah. Correct. But what it says here, you can discharge for complete discharge. Then, because of the way the statute is, the court may be consider at that time, can consider a conditional release. But that is highly unlikely, and that's also their sanctions involved to the detriment of the detainee by doing that.
Mr. Harbert, these changes, certainly I think we can all see what the changes are, but these changes appear to be relatively minimal to me. Now, I know you're taking the opposite position, and you're claiming that this changes the statute from a treatment statute to a punishment statute. Isn't that a huge leap? How do you get there with these relatively minor changes in the statute?
First of all, I don't think detaining a person for another year is minor, okay, before they can apply for supervised release. Whether you're detained by the Department of Corrections or by Department of Corrections people under contract to DOS or Department of Health and Social Services, it makes no difference to the person who's detained. They are basically being locked up. You also have to remember that all these people are people who have come out of the prison system. They've already been detained and now they're detained longer. Before they get treatment that supposedly they should have received while they're in prison in the first place. I don't think these are minor because even in my client's interest, especially my own client, if he's found to be a sexually violent person, but he's at a position where he can be released under supervised release, that's a substantial difference for him. Difference between confined, even though Sandridge, or whatever they call it now, the new one, may be deemed a treatment center, still prisoners, basically.
Let's assume that treatment is successful, and it's successful in a time shorter than 18 months. Isn't it possible for there to be a release, though? Can't the director of the institution ask for a discharge or petition the clerk to look at it again? Can't the individual ask for a reexamination?
The individual under this, I don't think, can ask for a supervised release. He'd have to ask for a full discharge, which really is unlikely. The director can petition for supervised release, but that was there before. But again, you're relying totally on an agent of the state, the people who are confining him. You're totally at their mercy as to when you can get out. And what we're looking at here, I think, and you look at equal protection grounds and all these sort of mix, the more I read this stuff, the more it sort of mixes in my mind, but you know, they're treated substantially different than someone on a Chapter 51 or an NGI plan or a 971-17. They are treated totally different. They are not given the same rights. And that was sort of the basis, or it was the basis, for your upholding this law in the first place, that these are all people being detained purportedly civilly, and they should all have substantially equal treatment. And now they're not. If you have to rely totally on the person confining you to seek access to the court, then how is that fair treatment? How is that due process? You're at the mercy of the state, you know, to get before the court. Also, it says here, it points out that under section 980.07 sub 3, the first chart on the top in the middle, that the court can re-examine at any time. If you look at that section, however, it says the court can re-examine, but it doesn't give the court any authority to change anything. You'd have to imply that the court, say for instance, the court had information that Mr. Rachel could get out earlier, even though the director didn't provide that. And the court orders re-examination. Nothing in that statute gives the court authority to do anything about it.
Who would petition the court?
But the only one who would petition for the re-examination? Mm-hmm. That's not clear to me, Your Honor. When you look at
that... It's usual for the court to just let it by its own hook.
I've never seen a court do that, so I doubt it would. Someone would have to bring it to the court's attention. It's certainly not going to be the institution if they don't feel he's ready for it.
No, because they can do one or the other.
Right. So how that practically will work, I don't know.
In the Kansas case that the United States Supreme Court took and upheld the sexual predator law of Kansas, I did not read that case. According to the state brief, Kansas did not have supervised discharge, and yet that statute was upheld.
I understand that, Your Honor, and that presents difficulties for me, but I have to look at what this court did with the Carpenter case and the Post case.
So what I hear you saying, what I understood from your brief, was that this court looked at the statute, found it constitutional. It's been changed, and essential elements of the statute that this court found made the statute treatment have now been repealed. And so your position is that the Carpenter case does not stand solid because some of the footings have been removed.
Absolutely. If you look at Carpenter decision page 266 under the West Second, this court went through the various. There was an attack by the petitioner saying, you know, this isn't fair, we're not treated equally. And this court cited almost the whole page everything that it felt was a basis to support this constitutional equal protection basis, actual factors, everything is basically here. All that is gone. Everything that this court talked about in regards to supervised release, having the ability to petition this court or the trial court for release, everything was basically wiped out.
But Carpenter ruled on the federal constitution.
Yes.
And so Carpenter, under the federal constitution, might have required more than ultimately the United States Supreme Court required.
That's possible.
And if that's true, then this court can easily say, okay, we demanded more under the federal constitution, but the United States Supreme Court is the ultimate decision maker as to what the U.S. What the U.S. Constitution stands for. Therefore, this is perfectly good because it meets whatever Kansas did.
Well, I would still argue, Your Honor, that even if you apply the Hudson rule that the Supreme Court has now gone into, that it still does not meet constitutional muster. If you look first.
Why not?
Well, first of all, Hudson Rule talks that you have to look at the label, and I think this court has already labeled this as a civil matter. But that's not the end point, even though it sort of argued that that's the end point. That's just one, it makes it a little harder to find something unconstitutional. But then you look at the other seven factors that you have to consider to see whether what they've done here is draconian, goes beyond what's reasonable. First of all, you look at would this be considered an affirmative restraint? I don't think you cannot consider locking someone up, whether it be in a treatment facility or wherever, is not an affirmative restraint. They don't want to be there and they can't leave. It's as simple as that. The next one, censure is a factor. Is intent a factor? That went a little hard for me. I don't know what they mean by that, but certainly all these guys, or I think they're all guys right now, are locked up because they intentionally committed a crime, some sort of sexual offense. So it is a factor in the overall scheme. Does it promote the traditional aim of punishment, i.e. retribution and deterrence? Again, by locking someone up who just come out of the prison system and then saying, listen, we're going to lock you up again and we can't get supervised release, that is deterrence, that is punishment. It's an extension, basically, of their sentence. Is it historically regarded as punishment? Yes. Whether you lock someone up in a prison or you lock someone up in a mental hospital, it's still considered punishment. And people don't want to be there, they're not free to go. Is it behavior to which it applies is already a crime? Well, I suppose technically no, but in theory it is, because they're being locked up because of what they have done was a crime. Well, they haven't committed a new crime, and that's always an issue here. There is no new crime, but they're being detained anyway. Is there an alternative purpose to which it may be rationally be connected? In other words, is there a reasonable alternative purpose? And I assume that that's the state's argument, that they have a substantial reasonable reason for doing this. But that's not articulated in the legislation. Apparently this was part of the budget bill. We don't know why they made these changes. There's some speculation going on here, but I guess that's a creature of the budget bill. A lot of things are thrown in and no one knows why. They just decided to take all this out.
Well, the state's brief indicates very, very few people of the total number have been released on supervised for release. Seems like a lot of fuss for nothing.
The six individuals who were really, or however many were, that is a lot. I mean, if we're going to lock someone up, it makes a big difference if they're going to be able to get out or if they're going to be locked up for the rest of their life. You can say the same thing about capital punishment, anything else. If it's one person who should be released isn't, I think that's a significant indication, especially in this law, which basically is equivalent, in many cases, it can be equivalent to a life sentence. And what's going to happen to a lot of these individuals who have not been convicted of new crimes.
Counsel, the problem I have is this. But Carpenter did rely on the intent of the legislature that this be civil rather than criminal. But of course it went behind that label and looked at what was additional information. And Carpenter, as your brief notes, relies heavily on the provision that there is to be treatment for the sexual predator, and that there is an opportunity to petition for supervisory release, and that supervisory release is an option at disposition before you even go in and hearing on that. And those components, in large part, were what Carpenter relied on to verify, if you will, that the label civil really was civil. Since Carpenter, I have grave reservations about whether or not there's been any treatment. We've had many cases. Frosty comes to mind. they can't get treatment plans. They can't get places for supervisory release. Appears to me to be the picture. So I think the treatment component, in large part, is a fallacy. The supervisory release, as an important component upon which Carpenter relies, is not only a fallacy now, it's in large part a non-existent, and arguably that which is in existence is just pretextual. Again, not really truthful. But all of that aside, you still have Kansas versus Hendricks, which didn't have any supervisory release. And was noted page 33 of the state's brief, the United States Supreme Court observed that it was consistent even when it did not have any supervisory release component at all. It was consistent with the constitutional mandate. So how do you get around that? Even if the treatment is a fallacy, even if the right to petition no longer for supervised release no longer exists, even with those two, how do you get around Kansas?
Yeah, it's my belief that to get past equal protection, due process, you have to look at the class of people we're talking about. This court found that Chapter 980 is consistent with our Chapter 51. There's some arguments consistent with NGI pleas. As it's now changed, it's no longer consistent. They are now making this a separate subclass. I don't know for sure what Kansas, as far as their civil commitments are, whether they're consistent. I do know that Chapter 980 is no longer consistent with our civil commitments. It's no longer consistent with the NGI rights people have at the front NGI. I do know, even though it's argued, that maybe these people aren't as dangerous as 980. I would dispute that, having been a trial lawyer many years. A lot of these people who are found civilly committed or NGI are very dangerous people.
But it's not for us to dispute that. That's a legislative determination.
I'm sorry.
Even while reasonable people might disagree about that, that's a legislative policy determination. The legislature determines that sexually violent people, because of the propensities to reoffend, deserves to be treated somewhat differently than other civil commitment candidates, at least to the extent of the original or initial placement decision. If there's a rational basis for that, we've got to respect it, don't we?
Well, first of all, I don't know what the rational basis is for changing this. They just stuck in the budget bill, so we don't know what sort of rational criteria they put on this. And I also think even the legislature has to look and follow due process and be consistent with similar people in similar circumstances. Chapter 980 is no longer consistent with Chapter 51 or with 971.17. They basically put out a subclass of people without any reasons.
Why does it need to be perfectly consistent?
Well, it needs to be perfectly consistent, but I think for due process purposes, people in similar situations have to be treated similarly, including giving the same rights that they have to everyone in that class, and that's not true anymore. It doesn't have to be word for word. But
similar doesn't mean identical.
Doesn't mean identical, but to me, whether you can petition for immediate release under 51 or under Section NGI, and possibly get supervised release as a substantial right is no longer afforded people under Chapter 980.
This is a mandatory minimum, isn't it?
That's what it sounds like to me.
And the institution can look out, but they have to find you first.
I'm sorry, Aaron?
They have to find you first so you're not lost in the bureaucracy.
Yes.
And then agree that you ought to. We have to take appropriate steps to get plans and get placements and all that versus just keeping them there.
That's right, for people who they should have been doing this years before.
Well, let me just, when you say the institution has to find you, I think you can find yourself there in the sense that you have the right to petition yourself. I mean,
under 980, you mean?
Right.
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought you were talking about when they petitioned to have them committed. I think under 980, obviously, you have to seek treatment, but treatment isn't working.
So, yeah.
As you can see from the number of people who aren't released.
But there are penalties if you petition too much.
Absolutely.
I mean, the whole goal is stop all these petitions.
That seems to be a goal because people are petitioning on a regular basis. They set up the petition by default by not doing anything. And, obviously that puts a hinder on the courts, but that doesn't make it wrong. There's nothing else. Apparently my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ronnie Einstein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state. How are you, sir?
I'm Warren Weinstein, an Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. I disagree that this is a mandatory minimum. I disagree that this has changed, that is, this has removed supervised release. It's changed the timing. There's no doubt about that. But as I think the chart accurately shows, there are still, the court can order a reexamination at any time. The purpose of the reexamination, I'm paraphrasing from 980.07, the purpose of the reexamination is to determine whether or not the person is sufficiently improved for discharge or supervised release. I think Mr. Hart's correct that the statute doesn't specifically say the court can enter a supervised release order. In the normal situation, the periodic re-exam is required at 6 months, and it is automatically filed with the circuit court. And then the periodic re-examination is conducted every year thereafter. I might point out that that conforms with the timelines in Chapter 51. Now, the court, on its own, can order a re-exam at any time. Prisoners write courts all the time. I can't imagine why a committed person couldn't write to court and say, I've become sufficiently improved that I ought to be on supervised release. If the circuit court thought that that deserved a hearing, it could order a re-exam and have a hearing. The other thing is, while it's true that the petitioner can't petition, the director of the institution can. And I would say, if you put Section 5161 together with 908.09/10, there's an affirmative obligation on behalf of the director of the institution to petition when someone is determined to no longer require secure mental health facility, or when someone's eligible for discharge. And we know from the U.S. Supreme Court that at the point at which a person committed civilly no longer is either mentally ill or dangerous, the Constitution requires their release. Now, to me, the secretary and the director of the institution both have an affirmative duty to monitor that and to petition the court, which they have statutory authority to do, as soon as one of those conditions abate.
How many such petitions have been filed during the life of this law, which is, what, about 5 years? 8 years.
For supervised release?
Yeah.
By petitioners? I mean, by committed persons?
No, by the director or the secretary.
They haven't, as far as I know, they haven't, no one's been released. I believe there have been a few recent hearings set based on reexaminations for...
No, but I mean, what about the secretary can authorize?
There have been, I think, one or two discharges, but I'm not sure. The problem is none of the records never show this sort of thing because of the way the cases come up. So most of the data that I get, I have to call over to DHFS and say what's going on, how many people. There are.
I am asking these questions.
Yeah. There are a few, very few, who have been released, discharge totally. I'd say under five. I think two is the number, but I'm not positive.
And how many did the director petition for supervised release?
I don't know who petitioned on those people, whether it was the committed person or the director. Well, now, petition for discharge is the secretary, not the director.
Petition on the the supervised person's behalf for supervised release.
For supervised release, the director of the institution petitioned.
Right.
For discharge, the secretary.
Right. That's your boxes say that.
Right.
Right. So I want to know how many have the director petitioned for.
I don't think he has, but you have to understand that with the old law, most of these guys have been petitioning regularly, and in fact, I've had cases where I've had supervised release, Mr. Sprosty's one. Supervised release petitions on all three levels of the court system all at the same time. So there's certainly no lack of supervised release petitions.
So why do you think the legislature got rid of this provision where the petitioner, when the petitioner seems to be the only one that is seeking supervised release?
Well, Mr. Hart's correct. There's nothing official
right. What's
in any of the records.
Word?
But from my understanding, the DHFS people were being told by treatment people that these guys required a certain period of secure treatment prior to being sufficiently dangerousness being sufficiently lowered to allow release in the community. I have to believe, although this is totally a guess, that the hostility of the public to these people coming out on supervised release, and I think Justice Bradley is absolutely correct in the cases that have come before this court where there's been supervised release ordered at an early period, it's been very difficult to place these people, and the primary reason for that is not anything to do with the state or the ability to find placements, it's the hostility of the general public to these people, because we've had instances where halfway houses have accepted these people and then rejected them after the public started, became all up in arms. We've had instances of private housing that's been withdrawn after that sort of thing. So I'm sure that had some dynamic in the politics of having this change. But it is true that the treaters tell DHFS and have told us when we've had trainings that these folks do require a certain period of secure treatment.
It's a general rule rather than individualized.
Right. It is a general rule, which I take under due process analysis is perfectly acceptable. And you know, the primary case of that is United States versus Jones, it seems to me, where the United States Supreme Court said, well, you know, we've just had an NGI hearing. We think it's reasonable for Congress to say that they're not going to devote the resources of the government to have another hearing to determine dangerousness. We're going to let the NGI finding, even though it's by a preponderance, to be sufficient to establish dangerousness.
Mr. Weinstein, there was some mention by one of the justices in regard to lack of treatment. And I'm wondering myself what the situation is in regard to the treatment facility that we heard about a year and a half ago is being about ready to open. Has that facility ever opened?
It has. And it's my understanding there are approximately half of the people who've been committed have been transferred there. They've also hired a gentleman by the name of Dr. Thornton, I don't know his first name, from England, who's come over to, yet again, it is true, this has been a developing thing. The treatment has been in place at WRC. It has changed a number of times, and it is changing again with the addition of Dr. Thornton, but there has been treatment. One of the things that also occurs in these cases is that we have an awful lot of these folks who deny their responsibility for their crimes, and treatment people believe, right or wrong, that they can't be effectively treated when they're in denial. So, I mean, that also plays in. But I don't think it's fair to say that there hasn't been treatment available in a secure facility. It's also never, as my experience has never has been, that there's never been a problem acquiring outpatient treatment for these guys. The problem has always been housing. And primarily it's because of the public. But they've always been able to find outpatient treatment.
Can you say about half of them have been transferred to the new facility?
To Sand Ridge, yes.
Is that about 100? Or what's the number?
It's more than 100.
More than 100?
Yeah. I don't know the exact number of persons committed. I think it's in the neighborhood of 280. And I think there are about 110 at Sand Ridge right now. And they're continuing to transfer them. I don't know what the criteria was, but they're transferring them in stages. And the ultimate goal is to transfer all of them to Sand Ridge, which I think should be done by certainly by the end of this year.
Counsel, I'd like to go through your chart, Chapter 980 timeline. and look at the after the enactment?
Mm-hmm.
Well, reasonable minds differ on all of these issues, or can differ on all of these issues, but I've become rather cynical in this area, I think, because although words convey a meaning, actions don't always follow the words, and that's what, at least is my belief of what's transpired. For whatever purpose, for whatever reason, it hasn't come about as we were led to believe in 1996, when when Assistant Attorney General Weldon stood up and argued the Carpenter case in the Post. I just want to go through this chart to examine whether this indeed is pretextual. Court can order reexamination of the sexual predator at any time. 980.073. That deals with, is that provision, did that survive the amendment?
Yes.
Sub 3?
Yes, that's unchanged. And by the way, equal protection, in my view, wasn't in this case. It wasn't certified by the Court of Appeal and hadn't been briefed, and I didn't see a strong equal protection claim until a reply brief. But I did, recognizing that this court can address it if it chooses, I did pull some of the quotes out of Post, and Post actually addressed a number of these equal protection claims, if you will, as compared to Chapter 51, and based on distinctions of dangerousness, found all except the jury trial to be not volatile of equal protection. And the things that the court relied on in Post in its equal protection claim, none of those things have been changed except the ability of the circuit court to order supervised release at the time of the initial commitment. So it seems to me the real question becomes, is it reasonable for the legislature, given that there are certain procedural safeguards through the ability of the secretary and the director to petition, and the fact that the reexamination has not changed at all, is it in that environment reasonable for the legislature to say we're not going to allow petitioners to file a supervised release petition for 12 months longer than they would have? That's what the case comes down to, it seems to me. And Mr. Hart's position, I think, has to be that change has, one, converted a civil statute into a criminal statute, and I might add, under Hudson, we can't look. That's the big difference, it seems to me, between Hudson and Halford. We can't look at what's actually going on. Due process and ex post facto in determining whether a statute is civil or criminal looks only at the statutory scheme. And if, in fact, what's going on doesn't conform with the statutory scheme, the remedy is to sue to get it to conform, not release, not declaring the statute to be penal in nature. So that has to change from civil to criminal. It has to be such as to not be justified on the basis of the dangerousness of these persons as compared to Chapter 51 committed persons, and it has to be a violation of substantive due process, because it can't be a violation of procedural due process, because the person just had a full-blown jury trial to the highest burden possible.
Well, let me take from that last phrase, the person has just had a full-blown jury trial. The court has determined, and the jury has determined, this is a sexually violent person, and there's going to be commitment. So I look again at the pretext. How realistic is the first chart, that the court can order re-examination at any time? How realistic is that 980073 when it doesn't indicate who, it doesn't provide any petition authority, nor does it allow for any authority to do anything other than order the re-exam or have the re-examination. But how... I just don't see that ever being utilized.
Well, and I would agree with you. In most cases, it's probably unrealistic. But by the same token, if that's true, why should we have a supervised release hearing right away? If the person isn't going to be sufficient, isn't going to be able to present sufficient evidence to convince a judge to have a re-exam and determine whether that their level of dangerousness has changed since the trial, then why shouldn't the legislature actually be entitled to say, we think, based on the fact that you've just been found to be sexually violent and dangerous, you should be in a secure mental health facility for treatment for a while. And that's really only 6 months, because, of course, that's a required exam, and that is transmitted to the circuit court. And certainly, if in that six-month exam, the re-examiner says, I think this guy's made a lot of progress in 6 months, and he's probably not as dangerous as he was, I can't imagine the judge isn't going to have a supervised release hearing on that.
Now, does that initial periodic re-examination go to the court?
Yes. The statute requires the reports to be filed with the court. And I might add, the committed person has the right to his own expert and to an attorney. Well, we have this Pollock procedure with the waiver, which, as far as I know, no one has ever signed, in which all of the reports not only get filed with the court, but the court has to have a paper review of them with counsel for both sides, and that is routine. So it's certainly, the re-exam is certainly brought to the attention of the court.
Well, there's an effect of judicial review in 6 months.
It amounts to a judicial review, yes.
A light one, but judicial review.
Well, it's not a fact finding as such. They don't have no evidence other than the reports.
But counsel's present.
Counsel is may be appointed, and in my experience is appointed, and there's oral argument.
Well, does Kansas v. Crane have any bearing on this case?
I don't really think so in the context of this case. As you know, the court has accepted a petition for review in Laxon, which is going to determine what it has in the general way. And certainly Mr. Rachel falls in that general category. But I don't think, let's assume that there's either no effect or whatever with Crane on the general population, then I don't think that would require any different result from this.
The court had a petition for review in another case, Randell.
Right.
Did that have an effect on this case?
Well, it's certainly Court of Appeals reasoning rejecting two of the arguments that Mr. Rachel raises. The Ransdell case was, three, I suppose. I tend to lump double jeopardy and ex post facto together because they both turn on the civil-criminal aspect, and it rejects that the amendment converted the statute into a criminal statute, and it also rejects a substantive due process claim. And I might add, there's another set of cases, a consolidated case by the name of State versus Isaac Williams and Hogan. I can't remember Hogan's first name, which is also very well. I think it's all three of the issues that the Court of Appeals certified in this case: due process, double jeopardy, ex post facto, and that may have had an equal protection claim in it. I'm not sure.
Let's can we go back a moment to the issue of the periodic reexamination, which occurs after the first 6 months and then annually thereafter under the revised statute, or actually under the old statute, too. That part remains the same.
That part remains the same.
You left the impression that there's a hearing and that to be heard and counsel is present and so forth. That's not how it happens. There isn't a hearing. There isn't council appointed rights to be heard, etc. That's a paper review of the
court. Yes, but the statute does allow for appointment of counsel, and
the statute allows for appointment of an independent examiner.
It does. Actually, the statute says at the time of the reexamination, which technically I suppose would be before the hearing. As a practical matter, I don't think it's really possible, and what we've been seeing is that the circuit judges have been appointing an independent examiner at the time of the hearing and then continuing the hearing.
There isn't a hearing. It's a paper review.
That's right, but it's paper from both the state's examiner and an independent person appointed, an independent expert appointed on behalf of the committed person. There's no evidence taken.
There isn't even a hearing. It's just a paper review.
There's supposed to be, or there may be, oral argument. I disagree with you on that.
Where does this provide for that?
In 98009.
Well, tell me if there's a...
98091A.
98091A. That's only if there's a petition. And the periodic review doesn't necessarily generate...
What happens is the 98091 requires this waiver at the time of the re-exam, as part of the re-exam. And if the petitioner refuses to sign the waiver, then this automatic hearing kicks in. That's State versus Pollock.
So, and what percent
I'm sorry.
Sign the waiver?
I'm sorry?
Is it usual for a person to sign a waiver?
I'm not aware of anyone who signed a waiver.
That's what I thought you said earlier.
And now the appointment of counsel and the appointment of the examiner is in 07. Statutes operate in tandem is that, at least from a practical standpoint, you get the re-exam by the state's expert. It's the committed person refuses to sign the waiver. It's forwarded to the court. The court appoints an attorney. The attorney requests an examiner. The court appoints the examiner, and then the court makes a determination on the two submitted reports and oral argument.
Counsel, so again, if I could just clarify, that applies to the situation where the sexually violent person has a statutory right to petition for this.
No, that's part of the reexamination process. I distinguish, and for this very reason, I distinguish between a petition for discharge and the reexamination process.
You will see the first sentence of 091 talks about a person can petition for discharge. That's the only mention of discharge in that section. The rest of it deals with the re-exam procedure and what happens if the court finds probable cause after the re-exam. The real petition for discharge section is 98010. I distinguish between a petition for discharge by a petitioner, which I view as being brought under 98010, a petition for supervised release, which is brought under 98008, and the reexamination procedure under 98007. The reexamination is required under 07. Some of the rights are set out under 07. Other of the rights are set out under 98009.
Is there a cross-reference in missing?
Yes, there is.
That's not clear on the face of it from what I can tell.
There's no 98091A. It's a B. There's a 1 and then there's a B. At least in the 99-00.
So, you're probably right on that. My memory is faulty. I'm sorry, 98092A says a person may petition, and it goes on. That's the first sentence. That refers to petition for discharge. Then at the second sentence begins, at the time of an examination under 98071, the secretary shall provide the committed person. That's the waiver. And then it says, the secretary shall forward the notice and waiver form to the court with the report. If the person does not affirmatively waive, the court shall set a probable cause hearing.
But that's a petition for discharge. That's not a petition for
discharge. No, that's part of the 98007 process. At the time of the reexamination under 98071, 98071 is reexamination.
Right, and it requires the petition.
And that is not a petition for discharge. It is a reexamination that is automatically forwarded to the secretary. The secretary shall forward the notice and waiver, not a petition. The notice and waiver.
I know. And what it says is that the secretary has to, at that hearing, advise the secretary of the person of his right to petition for discharge in the absence of the secretary doing so, or waive it.
Right.
It doesn't say anything about supervised release, which is, I think, Mr. Hart's position here.
That's true. But...
And
it's also true that 07 doesn't say anything about supervised release, ordering supervised release. But it says, but 98007 says that the purpose is any person who's committed under 98006, which is the commitment section, for the purpose of determining whether the person has made sufficient progress for the court to consider whether the person should be placed on supervised release or discharged. And I can't imagine how you can read that in any other way than the circuit court has the right to set a discharge hearing if that's what the report shows.
No, I don't disagree with you that the petition for discharge procedure is there and can be triggered at 6 months. The petition for supervised release is not. And I think Mr. Hart's point is that it's counterintuitive to think that anybody who was committed 6 months ago is going to be ready for discharge in 6 months, but they might be ready for supervised release. And so the withdrawal of that option makes the first 18 months of this commitment punitive. That's how I understand.
Well, I would disagree with that, but I think
the procedure correct.
Well, I don't think so, no. And that's because, in my view, the re-exam at six months for the purpose of determining whether someone has sufficiently improved to be considered for supervised release gives the circuit court the authority, when they get a report which is automatically filed with them, they read the report, this person has improved sufficiently to be placed on supervised release, let's have a supervised release hearing.
Right, gives the court the right to do that, or the secretary,
that's right.
But not the sexually violent person.
Right, but the whole question is, with those kinds of safeguards, may the legislature then say the petitioner can't file a petition for 18 months? And it seems to me that we again come down to the fact that if it's true, that it's unlikely that anybody is going to determine that somebody ought to have a supervised release hearing before 18 months, then it seems to me the legislature is perfectly authorized to be, it's perfectly reasonable for the legislature to say, well, then we won't allow petitioners to file until 18 months. There are safeguards for when someone becomes less dangerous earlier, and that's the key. And by the way, that's what the post decision relied on. They didn't rely on the supervised release petition determination at the beginning of the process in terms of an equal protection or due process claim. It was part of the analysis in the double jeopardy case, Carpenter. Certainly a lot of the Halpern language is quoted in Carpenter, and there's specific mention in that decision about
counsel is very effective. would it be okay if the statute said there could be no petition for supervised release for 6 years?
Well, in my view, yes. And the reason is because I don't believe that there's any requirement on the state to have supervised release at all. But you don't have to decide that question in this case. I mean, if, when you look at the due process claims, the Supreme Court consistently says, so long as the state proves a mental disorder of some sort and dangerousness by clear and convincing evidence, the state may commit the person until such time as they are no longer mentally ill or dangerous. Now that language to me says there's no requirement for some intermediate release. The legislature is, of course, free to offer that, but as a matter of constitutional requirement.
So from your perspective, there's no requirement for these periodic exams, there's no requirement for a petition for discharge, and there's no requirement for petition for supervisory release, let's say, for the first 6 years.
I would say there is a requirement for periodic examination. There is a requirement for petition for discharge. But that's where I would stop.
I was a little surprised at your brief, which was excellent, that you just didn't take the position that the Wisconsin statute without supervised release is like the Kansas statute. That's upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's the end of the case.
Well, the problem with that approach, it seems to me, is that the question was not directly presented in Hendricks. The question presented in Hendricks in supervised release, I mean in the substantive case, wasn't raised in either of those cases. And that's the problem with relying solely on Hendricks, it seems to me. So I do think one can say, gee, if that was a requirement, the Supreme Court probably would have addressed it somehow, but I have to concede that that's perhaps not true.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Hart?
Thank you, Your Honor. Of interest to me, I think, which is also important to this court, is in Mr. Weinstein's initial 2 or 3 minutes of comment, he talked about the duty of the director and his obligation to submit to the court if he feels someone should be released. And he says that duty is implicit in both Chapter 51, Section 51.61, and Section 908.09, Sub 10. So, in effect, the state is saying that these two sections have to be looked at together. They have similar characteristics, but now we can change it. So we take a little bit from 51, and that's all right, but forget the rest of it. Again, we're supposed to apply this on equal protection due process grounds to similarly situated persons, and they do that as long as it meets their criteria. As soon as it doesn't, well, then we can take this part, but not the rest. And I think that's wrong. I think basically the state concedes that Chapter 980 individuals are in a similar situation as 51, as this court has so ruled in the past, and similar to NGI. I'd point out to the court, there's all this discussion about Hudson. And I think, like everyone else, puts ex post facto law and double jeopardy together. They're very similar, but Hudson deals with double jeopardy. It does not necessarily apply to the analytical framework for the other things we're looking at here. So I think that Hudson applies just to one aspect of what we're looking at here. Basically, Your Honor, one other thing I'd point out, the court mentioned the two cases, the Williams and Ransdell from the First District that have come through. I think the court's decision in this case will impact those directly. I just point out that if the court looked at those cases, they will find that the First District basically didn't really address or try to figure out how they could distinguish Carpenter and Post. They sort of almost ignored them and went on and went into the strict scrutiny test and tried to distinguish and separate 980 from everyone else. So they really didn't do, which I think this court has to do, is distinguish why they can go that route. They just basically went that way and said, well, now we can treat these people differently than we have in the past, and how that jives with Carpenter and Post, it doesn't. They just basically ignored it. So, if there's nothing else, Your Honor, on behalf of my client, I appreciate the opportunity to address you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hart, for your presentation this morning, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for yours. The court is appreciative of your efforts to be here and represent your clients so well. Thank you both.